1:49 p.m. on Wednesday, February 22nd. Two caps. Present today are Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Representative Colomb, Representative Ortiz, Representative Kronk, Representative Tomaszewski, and myself, Co-Chair Johnson. Assisting us today, we have our LIO moderator, Emma Turner, and our finance secretary, Bree Wiley. Today, we're receiving a budget overview from the Department of Environmental Conservation, presented by Jason Bruni, the commissioner. Commissioner Bruni, would you like to come forward, please? Put yourself on the record and introduce any additional presenters.
Thank you, Chair Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Bruni. I'm the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and happy Ash Wednesday. Don't worry, it's not dirt on my forehead, but after presenting to the United Fishermen of Alaska and to my chair, Tomaszewski's committee this morning, I found time to go to Mass, so good Catholic boy. Anyway, thank you for the opportunity to present today about the overview of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Our mission is one focused on, long and short, protecting human health and the environment. Obviously very important to all of us as Alaskans. There is a component of our mission, obviously, that's very important, and it's also looking after the economic and social well-being of Alaskans. And one thing that my boss, Governor Dunleavy, loves to say is no one does it better than Alaskans do. So this is something that we obviously strive at, partnering with the regulated community, making sure that the development, either fishing, mining, timber, tourism, cruise ships, you name it, is done with an emphasis, obviously, on making sure we're protecting human health and the environment. The values that we put into place when I became commissioner, I worked with my directors to focus on what is it we do at DEC and what do we want to focus on every single thing we do. And obviously customer service was of utmost importance, but collaboration, integrity, accountability, and objectivity are incredibly important to everything that we do. DEC has five divisions. The Division of Administrative Services, obviously, is what Meg oversees. She is our ASD, and she'll be talking more in detail about our budget later on in the presentation. But we also oversee programs that are put in place by Congress, through the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act. We have primacy of these programs. In a federalist system, states have the opportunity to take over these programs, and we have done just that. We were formed 51 years ago, right about a little after the EPA was formed, and the four divisions, obviously, are very similar to those programs with which the Congress passed, and we have primacy over. Air quality, water quality, and the NPDES program. Environmental health, which has the state veterinarian, has the safe drinking water program in it, and then of course SPAR, after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and as a young biologist I got to work on the Valdez oil spill and oiled otters, but that's something that obviously we want to ensure never happens again in the state, so it's imperative that we work with the oil industry and those folks that are in communities that handle diesel fuel and things like that to ensure that prevention is what we're focused on. Yes, there are times when spills happen and we have to clean it up, but we want to really put an emphasis on prevention. So that's the five divisions that we have at DEC. We put in metrics to measure to be accountable to the legislature and to the Alaskan public. How do you measure what you do? So this past year, we authorized through either permits, approvals, certification, plan reviews, over 10,000 items for the regulated community in Alaska. That's some of these, you'll see that the number is down from 2021, but there are some of our permits that go every other year, so that's not an anomaly. In order to make sure that folks are following the stipulations that they have in their permits and the requirements that they have to do and the regulations and the statutes that you all give us to follow, we need to make sure we go and do inspections of sites to make sure that the permitted regulated community is following through. And so this past year, you'll see we had an uptick of about 50% more inspections and site visits this past year. Well, obviously that is directly related to COVID. We were really focusing on trying to use these during COVID. You can do virtual inspections. You can just as easily talk to someone, and we're trying to incorporate that more into our daily routine as it is to save travel costs, and also to have a better relationship with the regulated community when they have questions about what we're doing, about what they're doing, and how we can help, them better protect human health and the environment. We don't necessarily always have to travel to see them, so we've really put an emphasis on trying to increase virtual inspections as well. During the pandemic, we had close to 85 to 90% of our staff that were teleworking. Really wanted to put an emphasis on that. I think that there is a huge opportunity to evaluate employees based on the work they're supposed to be doing, not the time that their butt's in a seat. And so that's something we put in place during the pandemic. We're evaluating the employees on how many widgets they need to create, how many permits that they need to authorize, how many inspections they need to do. And so to have access, and even after the pandemic, we probably have around 75% of our employees that telework at least 2 days a week. That's great. I really want to put an emphasis on that. That's going to ultimately save us money and help with retention in the long term. In order to have access to that information, though, to do their jobs, you have to get all of the 51 years worth of material that we've managed to collect in file cabinets over the years scanned so that they can see it from home. So we, over the course of the last 2 years, we've eliminated over 500 file cabinets worth of material and scanned that. And then, of course, one of my big emphasis areas is retention. So when I got into this job, we were losing somewhere between 25 to 30 out of every 100 employees a year. So 25 to 30% annual turnover rate. When you're trying to do timely, science-based, legally defensible permits for the regulated community, you can't be losing 3 out of 10 employees on an annual basis. We had to put things in place to improve that. Now, teleworking was one thing that's helped with that, but the other is showing our employees that there are career opportunities to matriculate up at DEC, to show them that, to ask them, what are your 1-year, 3-year, 5-year goals? How can we help develop you? How can we invest in you so that you want to stay at DEC longer? So we've really put an emphasis on training, and what's really exciting is there's over 40 hours of training per employee that's occurred at DEC over the last year, and we've seen our retention rate fall from 30, our turnover rate fall from 30% to 14%. So it's still not great. I'm not excited about a 14% turnover rate, but during the year of the Great Resignation, having only losing 14% of our employees, I'm pretty damn proud of that. So training is a huge component of it, and trying to make sure that folks understand that we believe in them, we're investing in them, and we want to see a career path for them at DEC. The leadership team that I've assembled, obviously, I'm very proud of. We have over 100 years of state service in my leadership team. Crystal Kieneman has been up here on the Hill for the better part of 2 decades. Most of you know her. She's an amazing legislative liaison and special assistant. Emma Pocon is our deputy commissioner. She was formerly at the Department of Law, worked on the North Slope Borough, lived in Iqaluit for a couple of years, and has phenomenal environmental background with her legal background from the University of Vermont Law School. My directors, obviously Meg. Meg started at SPAR, Spill Prevention and Response, and eventually became our ASD this past year. Christina Carpenter has been the director of environmental health for nearly 8 years. This past year we had a huge, it was a big loss for DEC. Alice Edwards had been at DEC for 32 years and was our former deputy commissioner. And she got to retire. We're not supposed to allow people to retire, but I'm very happy for her. She was up texting our air director last night, I found out, at 11 o'clock, because she knew that we were going to be testifying this morning at 7 a.m. about air. So she's still actively engaged, but she gets to enjoy retirement, and I'm very happy with her. And Jason Olds was our previous head of enforcement for the Division of Air, and we were very happy to promote him from within. Tiffany Larson has been with the state for nearly 2 decades. She lives in Fairbanks. Tiffany used to be with AIR, used to be with Water, and used to be with SPAR, and she, again, nearly 2 decades with DEC, and she eventually promoted up to director. And then, of course, Randy Bates. Randy Bates has been the head of the ACMP program. He's been the head of the Habitat program. He's worked for and was the head of the OPOM program. So he's worked for Fish and Game, DNR. He's a commercial fisherman, and he's been in Bristol Bay as well as Southeast fisherman, and he's now been our water director for 3 years. So the amazing team I have to help protect human health and the environment and to work collaboratively with the regulated community is great, and I surround myself with people a lot smarter than I, and I'm fortunate to have this great team. As I indicated, we put a keen emphasis on retention. You'll see that this group right here, this is 25 of the brightest and best of DEC. We created the DEC Leadership Academy, and we brought them together, and we're with all of our directors, had a two-day meeting in October, and we meet every other week for a couple of hours and bring in leaders and talk about projects that they can do to try to better DEC. We're really excited about this group of future leaders at DEC and developing them. The vacancy rate that the committee has asked us to focus on, this is not a percentage of employees, but this is rather a dollar amount. So we budgeted a 5.24% vacancy rate, but actually ended up with a 6.37% vacancy rate for this past year. With that, I'm now going to turn it over to my Administrative Services Director, Meg Kohler, to talk about the specifics of our budget. But Madam Chair, if you'd like, I'm happy to answer questions before we get into specifics of the budget.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Through the chair, Commissioner, so great to see you. Say, I do want a little bit of clarification, if I can have that. Frankly, this looks like record-setting vacancy rate from what we've been seeing throughout the state in the report. So could you help me to understand how many positions that is then? I think you mentioned that it was a dollar amount. I'm wondering if you could share how many positions.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Galvin, thank you for that question. We have 516 positions, I believe, at DEC. And so the way that number is calculated is based on the dollar amount of, like, if you have a position that costs $100,000 and someone leaves, and then the day after they leave, you fill it with someone else, that's a 0% vacancy rate.
Mm-hmm.
So where that number comes from is if they're gone for a couple of months, you get a percentage of that salary, that dollar amount that gets you to that. It's not the retention rate.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
It does. So presently, how many positions have? Sorry, follow up through the chair, if I may.
Yes.
Thank you. Through the chair, that does help. I apologize for misspeaking. What I'm hoping is to know how many positions you have unfilled presently, if that's something you have on hand.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, thank you for that. This is something I have weekly leadership meetings with my teams, and I'm always asking them about this. We have a weekly newsletter that goes out. I think right now we have around, I think it's 15 positions that are currently vacant at DEC. I put a keen emphasis on if you're going to have the positions, fill the damn things. Otherwise, we're going to get rid of them. And so there were some positions that had been outstanding for a year and a half, 2 years, and I said, this is early on, we're not going to allow this to be a slush fund. If you want the positions, if we're going to ever try to go for additional positions, we have to show that we're filling the positions we currently have. And so that's been a keen emphasis. You're always going to have some rate of churn, and we try to emphasize promotion into those higher level positions, but right now it's somewhere between 10 and 15 positions that are currently vacant at DEC.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, good afternoon, Commissioner. It sounds like the employment situation is far improved, and I appreciate that. On the removal of positions, however, doesn't that mean that the canceling of a PCN would mean that you're effectively saying we're not going to do that work? Isn't that a concern? In other words, presumably that job was created because the work needed to be done, and the work will still need to be done even if you don't fill the position. And I'm just concerned, you know, I've got great passion for your SPAR division, and it's a notoriously sort of overworked agency. So how do you resolve that conundrum?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, thank you for that question. And I, too, have a passion for SPAR. And what I did in the first 2 years was not something that I was comfortable with. We had to eliminate, for those of you that did not know that weren't here, we had to eliminate 14 positions because the sustainability of funding for SPAR was not there. I was told when I started that in 4 years, we would have to eliminate 30 positions. because the SPAR is funded through 4 cents per barrel produced in the state for the prevention account and 1 cent per barrel produced in the state for the response account, as well as 0.95 cents per gallon of the refined fuel surcharge. That was put in place like 6 or 7 years ago. So when you fill your tank up and put 10 gallons of gas in, 9.5 cents of that 10 gallons comes to fund SPAR. A couple of years ago, so I wanted to bring sustainability both from I could have put my head in the sand and said, you know, this is someone else's problem. In 4 years, they're going to have to cut positions. That's not how I work. So we eliminated 14 positions, but I made a pledge that if they, because they had like 30 or so vacant positions at that same time as well. If you end up needing additional positions, I said to the SPAR director, come back to me and I will advocate for it. Tiffany Larson, I've said the exact same thing. The thing I'm so excited about, Representative Josephson, is that their training hours at SPAR are somewhere like 100 hours per employee. They are nearly double the DEC average for training. Their retention rates are the best at DEC. We have turned SPAR around, and I'm so excited about that effort. And we're also, Representative Josephson, still supportive of the increase of the refined fuel surcharge to bring sustainability from 0.95 cents to 1.5 cents. So I know that could be a potential follow-up question. I'm throwing that out on the record again just to say we are supportive of that. And sustainability of SPAR is imperative. It's something that's important to all of us, Representative Josephson. Thank you.
Good morning. Good afternoon. For the record, Megan Kohler, Administrative Services Director for the Department of Environmental Conservation. I'm here to give a overview of the operating budget for the department. So we'll start with kind of a broad, and then we'll go through each division.
Yeah. Just one moment. I'd like to go back to your vacancy rate.
Sure.
So we received the official vacancy rates, and they were quite a lot higher than that. We had admin at 15.9%, air quality at 13.1%, SPAR at 9.3%, and water at 7.4%. Would you just give me an overview of how you got to your vacancy rate?
Chair Johnson, my people gave it to me, so I will defer to my people. I'm being completely honest with you that I don't know. This is the number that I was told. So my apologies if the number is different. Meg, might you be able to address that?
Yeah, to the chair. So for this, as an adjustment to what the commissioner said, we're running, I think, between a 10 and 15% vacancy rate. I believe that's the number that was received during OMB's presentation earlier this session. These budgeted vacancy rates, so the vacancy rate, that's a monetary value of that we plan for moving forward, understanding that people move through the system and leave state service. And then our actual vacancy rate, that is what we, for FY22, actually saw as the amount of financial vacancy rate that we had, so personnel services, and that's why those numbers are different. This is the 6.37 is a vacancy, so that means shows from a sorry that is a vacancy from a monetary perspective of personnel services.
From a what perspective?
From a financial perspective, that's not personnel and people. That's a salary.
So just to follow up on that, I'm not entirely clear, but if you would provide for me and the committee your description of what you have there on the slide and reconcile that for us with the vacancy rate that we have been given, that would be much appreciated.
Yeah, Chair Johnson, we'll absolutely do that. Thank you for that question. I know one other thing just to consider is that some of the positions that the legislature approved this past year from an EJA, the infrastructure bill perspective, there's so much money out there that some of those positions have not even been created yet through OMB. So we're in the some of them, that might be some of the discrepancy as well, but Representative Chair Johnson will for sure get that number to you to clarify that. Thank you.
Thank you. And I wanted to make note, I see it says FY22, and I actually can't say that I have the FY22 budget or a vacancy rate in front of me, but the ones that we have for FY22, the ones that we have from OMB are significantly different. So anyway, if you would, that would be
Yeah, we will. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Stapp.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair to the folks at DCC. My apologies, I'm going to hit on this one more time. So what I think you are telling me is basically you are taking the vacancy factor out of the equation, because obviously we don't budget for all positions, and what you are showing us is the percent of positions are open and AKA vacant above our actual budgeted amount. Is that correct?
Representative Stapp, through the chair, I believe that is correct.
Okay, that's the discrepancy. Thanks.
And Representative Johnson, I was just handed a note that seems accurate, but again, I'm going to follow up, so for sure. But the numbers that you were given were at a given time, real-time numbers, not an average over the course of the year. And I believe this might be what the full final year, fiscal year number was. But again, we're going to get back to the committee with specifics on that. Thank you.
We appreciate that.
Continuing on, so this will be we'll do the department and then we'll go into specific divisions. For this department, I'd like to call the attention that this is our 22 actuals, our 23 management plan, and then our 24 gov amend for the graphs that you see. You'll see that there's a influx of EJA dollars, which we're really excited about. Those started in 23 and we're excited to move forward with those. So next slide. Starting with my division, a division of admin. Again, we're breaking these out just so you can kind of see the difference. And then below it, we've kind of got notes on kind of our increments or decrements. For this one, we have a office furniture replacement. This is related to the fact that our offices have not been updated since the early 90s in our Anchorage and some of our other offices. And during the earthquake, we saw a pretty substantial amount of damages that we've been kind of cobbling together. But at this point, for a safety perspective, we're looking to fix that for us. And this is federal indirect dollars that we have been working through to make sure that we have the ability to pay for. The other one is a proportionality true-up. We spend, DAS is funded proportionally to how our other divisions spend, and so this is a fund source change to better utilize our federal indirect dollars.
I have just have a question. On the office furniture, if it was something that was damaged, do we not have insurance, or is that just like a too small of an amount that didn't cover it, or is there something we could potentially make some kind of get reimbursed for in some way?
So we did utilize insurance to fix kind of the large scale, but at this point we're seeing kind of the damages along with the following day. Our roof came off of our building, and we had significant water damage. And so we have been, we did use insurance, but the scale of the problem has kind of progressed as we've moved through.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. On the same question, is that 2.5 for just the Division of Admin, or that's for the entire department through the Division of Admin's budget?
Through the chair, that is for the whole department. So this is building maintenance and operations. We have one office that DEC is one building that DEC is owns, which is the Environmental Health Lab. It is largely UGF funded with a small amount of federal indirect, and we have no significant changes for this year. For Environmental Health Lab, for the Division of Environmental Health, which also includes our Environmental Health Lab, but our building maintenance and operation is pulled separately. You can see here just a large influx of EJA dollars coming through. With that, with all of the infrastructure dollars coming into the state, we've seen an increase in multiple kind of venues for testing. and the fees associated with that. So this is the initial one is an increment to be able to accept those fees. And that's commensurate with the 23 supplemental. And then the second one, reoccurring reimbursable service agreements, that is kind of, we have unbudgeted RSAs that we are seeing consistently through the years. And so this is functionally a technical adjustment to be able to kind of eliminate some paperwork on our end.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through Chair Johnson, I hope that you could help me appreciate what the other is in the graph that has gone up. It looks like for 2024 in the governor's supplemental, there's a section that says other, the black line. What is that referring to?
I do not have those specific details with me right now. Oh, I do know what that is. I'm sorry. Those are the interagency receipts. Those are through the chair. My apologies. Those are the interagency receipts for our ability to accept funds.
Thank you so much.
Moving on to our air quality. We have two of our asks, which I know that the subcommittee has heard significantly about this morning. One is our state implementation plan. This is tied with the fact that we will have three state implementation plans due through 2026. Those are multi-year, multi-decade documents or processes with thousands of pages of reporting and requirements and planning. So we have asked through that, as well as the Rural Community Monitoring Network, which is a monitoring for wildland smoke across the state. Moving on to spill prevention and response, we have received through a federal earmark from McCreskey the dollar amount. I believe it's $7 million for 5 years, so we've parsed that out accordingly, and that is for assessment and verification of ANCSA-contaminated lands, and we're very excited for that to come through and to be able to utilize that. Next.
Representative Colomb.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, sorry you're moving fast. So I had a question on two slides back, I think it was. One more. The drinking, let's see. Is the air quality slide? Is it there? You're requesting a position or two more positions for the air quality monitoring. So the explanation here says that it's new technology that requires less staff time instead of a maintenance. So why are we requesting two positions?
Yeah. So through the chair. We have additional monitors that are going out that we obtained through federal dollars, as well as many communities are also investing into these kind of their low cost sensors. And so these positions will help maintain and continue operating of those. They do require year-round operation and maintenance.
Okay, may I have a follow-up here?
Follow-up, please.
Thank you. Through the chair. So is the monitoring network is the technology new, or is that happening now and it's just a different way of monitoring it?
Through the chair, Representative Colm, thank you for that question. For the record, Jason Bruni, DC Commissioner. It is new technology. A lot of people are buying their own individual, what are called purple air monitors. They're able to, but we need to make sure that we have the experts that are talking about where to position these, where to site them, and not having, it's great to have citizen scientists, but citizen scientists can often have their own agendas, and we need to make sure that we're working with them. We've gotten a lot of funding through EJIA dollars and otherwise to purchase these systems around the state. We need to make sure that they're getting installed and in the correct locations, that the data that's coming from them is properly interpreted. You could have these systems set up, but the interpretation is so incredibly important because it can be misused as well. So we're using this network to understand, where's the air quality issues coming from? Is it coming from fires from Russia? Is it coming from coal burning from China? Or is it coming from actual issues in Alaska? So that's part of the need for those two positions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Representative Josephson.
I think we're going to be moving on to the Division of Water next. And before we do that, could you tell, may I ask a question? Madam Chair?
I'm sorry.
May I ask a question? I have a question for the Commissioner.
Of course.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Through the Chair, Commissioner. Where do we stand on the regulation of effluent discharge and air quality monitoring for the cruise industry? What is DEC doing and with what dollars and personnel?
Sure. Representative Josephson, through the chair, thank you for that question. So the cruise industry, every single ship that comes into the state is inspected, and that's both large ships and small ships, is inspected within the first few weeks of their being in port. Previously, that had not been done. Only the large ships had ocean rangers on at the time. We do not have ocean rangers on every ship, but instead we're using those dollars to inspect them with DEC staff. Again, every single ship is inspected within the first few weeks. We also do surprise inspections, unannounced inspections on a regular basis. We're also monitoring the water quality in the corridors that the ships, the fishing boats, the cruise ships, common corridors use to understand what's the water quality issues there, as well as the water quality impacts of the in the ports. As you may recall, Representative Josephson, right before the pandemic struck, we were making very good progress on a bill to redo the Ocean Ranger program. It seemed very well greased, and then the dang pandemic hit, and we didn't reintroduce it. One of the hopes that we have is to be able to use that money that's collected for the Ocean Ranger fee for upgrading the shoreside wastewater treatment facilities, as well as electrifying docks, obviously having an incredible improvement on the environment for, of course, fewer carbon emissions. And many of the communities where these cruise ships visit are what are called 301H waiver communities. These are communities that are exempted from the state of Alaska's Clean Water Act, Alaska Pollution Discharge Elimination System requirements. And so you'll see a community like Ketchikan, which the community itself is allowed to discharge from their wastewater treatment plants 1.5 million fecal coliform units per 100 milliliters of water. The cruise industry, their max is 40 fecal coliform units per 100 milliliters of water. So 1.5 million versus 40. We hold ourselves, our communities, to a different standard because of the EPA 301H waiver than we do industry. And so that's one of the key emphasis that we're looking to do if that bill gets introduced, is to try to upgrade those communities. But again, back to your question, we're inspecting all the ships. We're making it a point of communicating, especially with the smaller ships, what we found with our inspections of the smaller ships, the Nat Geos. They're discharging 2 to 3 million fecal coliform units per 100 milliliters of water. They're not, frankly, in my mind, being good actors. And we have never historically inspected the smaller ships. We're holding them accountable, finally.
Did you say Nat Geos? What is that?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Joseph said National Geographic, the company that loves to publish a lot of pictures about Alaska and lock up Alaska, is actually in our waters discharging higher levels of fecal coliform than many of our communities are, and they're not being good actors.
Follow up. So the 301H is for our local governments. It's a waiver for our local municipalities?
Yep. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the 301H waiver allows those, I think it's 8 communities, it might be 7, it might be 9, to remain under the oversight of the Environmental Protection Agency rather than the state of Alaska. So we gained primacy of the NPDES program back from 2008 to 2012, we gradually assumed the program. And then the permits usually are renewed on an every 5-year basis, have gradually come on, but these communities onto state oversight. But those communities that have the 301H waivers, understandably so, want to remain under the 301, the H waiver program, because they have lower requirements. They don't have to put in secondary or tertiary discharges. If you look at Anchorage is the largest community in Alaska that's still on a 301H waiver. The cost to upgrade that system would be somewhere between $1.5 and $2 billion. And there will also be additional operational expenses on an annual basis, and those costs would be put onto ratepayers. The same if you upgraded Ketchikan or otherwise. So these communities that are on the 301H waivers, they're pretty happy to remain because it keeps their costs down. But it is having, in some instances, there is an increased environmental impact, especially for folks that are subsistence harvesters from fish in those areas, you name it. Not in Anchorage, but in some of the southeast communities.
Representative Josephson.
That strikes me as sort of an externality, the word that gets overused, that when we're looking at our budget, because I'm getting correspondence about Anchorage's lack of secondary and tertiary backup, and I've known about this been an issue for 20 years or more. But that strikes me as something where when we're looking at our budgets, we need to solve that rather than continuing to operate at this baseline. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, and it's a leading question, you can take it if you want, but it's an example of our underfunding something that would be good for Alaska. I mean, that's sort of what I hear you saying.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, amen. I agree completely with that. The thing that's great is we have billions of dollars of EJA funding that just happen to be coming in right now to be able to help these communities upgrade. Now, that said, the ongoing OPEX that's going to these communities are going to have is still going to be put on the ratepayers. There's still going to be additional costs that they'll have to pay, but we are working our Village Safe Water Program, our State Revolving Loan Fund Program has been funded significantly to be able to help these communities get off of the 301H waiver and get onto the state and upgrade the quality of their wastewater discharges. I think it's incredibly important.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Through the chair, so what I'm hearing, Commissioner, I'm going to put this in very simple terms because I haven't been tracking as long as my colleague. What I'm hearing is that the federal funds that may offer an opportunity for us, especially given that Anchorage is one of the major or the largest 301H communities, meaning that it has a waiver that is allowing it to pollute the water, essentially. And I'm sure I'm not saying that politically correctly, but what I'm hearing is that the opportunity is here if we are to appreciate also that it will be a cost to citizens additionally, but there will be an opportunity to change this up in the near term. Is that what I'm hearing?
So through the chair, Representative Galvin, thank you for that question. For the smaller 301H waiver communities in mm-hmm. Southeast, absolutely. Okay. We use science as the foundation of our decision-making at DEC, and the science for the Aspelin facility at AWWU has shown that there are not fecal impacts to Cook Inlet. There's such a huge amount of flow that flushes it in and out every day. And you talk to Mark Corsentino, the head of AWWU, and you look at the science, it is actually designed with a mixing zone that isn't having a negative impact. And so what I have seen is that secondary and tertiary treatment are not necessary in Anchorage. Now, does that mean we shouldn't do it? No. But remember, I said there's several billion dollars for those communities. Anchorage alone is going to cost several billion dollars. So I think that's an additional ask from your keynote speaker at your joint session earlier today that you may want to talk about. And there's been a lot of folks that have been interested in that. But from a scientific perspective, the flushing that's occurring in Cook Inlet actually allows for that 301H waiver to not have an impact from the city of Anchorage.
Thank you. Follow-up, please, if I may. Thank you. So perhaps Anchorage would not be as important considering all of the science presently and its impacts. But what I did hear, I think, is Ketchikan and other communities who may have the 301H, they are impacted based on the science that you have. And there is opportunity based on what we're hearing from our present senator today. And so, but there will be costs associated in addition to whatever we get from the federal side. Yes?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, the exciting thing about what we have in Ketchikan is that funding is there. The reason why we have to upgrade them, we have to bring either UV treatment or chlorination or something of that sort, is because there are impaired water bodies around Ketchikan that we've designated because of the high fecal levels. We have to address that issue scientifically and from a management perspective. We have to address it. Otherwise, DEC cannot give what's called a 401 certification of the permit, the extension of the 301H waiver. We have to make sure water quality standards are maintained, and we can't ensure that that happens unless at least some kind of an upgrade occurs. And so, yes, the money is there to be able to upgrade those systems. There will be additional costs, but it's a great opportunity with the EJA funds.
Thank you, Chair. May I ask one last follow-up?
One last follow-up.
May I ask what you referred to the 401 permit that you would be able to give if this work was done? Can you describe what that is used for and why we would be interested in that?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Galvin, through the chair. So the Division of Water gives what are called 401 certifications of water quality standards for either 301H waiver permits or for 404 permits, which we'll be talking about later. Obviously, we're interested in assuming the 404 dredge and fill program, but that is our way, DEC's way, of ensuring that a federal permit that's going to be authorized is going to be maintained to ensure water quality standards are maintained. And so that's what a 401 certification is.
Thank you, Chair.
So just reminder, as fascinating as all of this is, we're really here to dig into the DEC budget. I think Representative Staff has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the Chair, the DEC folks. Yeah, I was going to say this fascination discussion on flushing poop into the water, but I'm just curious, real quickly, the IJA funding, you had mentioned funding source was going to be local utility ratepayers, right? So in order to access that funds for the things that these folks are talking about, the local municipalities, their public utilities are going to be leveraging those funds on their own accord without our involvement, probably, would be my guess. Is that correct?
So Representative Stepp, through the chair, we have a program that allows these communities to borrow money through the State Revolving Loan Fund. And up to 49%, and that's very low interest rates, like 1.5 to 2% or so interest rates. So the communities are able to borrow the money, but 49% of that is forgivable. And that actually does come through this body. It goes through Village State. It comes from the EPA through the federal funding dollars, and then it goes out to those communities through the State Revolving Loan Fund and the subsidies that we're able to give through that program.
Follow up. So I understand real safe water forgivable. Is municipality of Anchorage, is that forgivable too?
Through the chair, Representative Staff, there are programs that are forgivable through the State Revolving Loan Fund that I believe the municipality of Anchorage is able to take. But I will follow up with you to confirm that. I believe usually there has to be an income issue, but I'm pretty confident that there is some that is, not all, but some that are forgivable or that are subsidized in Anchorage. But I'll confirm with you, Representative.
Okay, thanks.
Moving on to the Division of Water, for this, and we'll start with the 404 feasibility study funding. This is a technical correction, obviously. The legislature gave us that funding last year to conduct that feasibility study, which we delivered. And so this is just a correction. It was carried forward and needs to be cut. The second one, which is the Bureau of Land Management Good Neighbor Authority, that was money awarded to BLM through the Gravel to Gravel Keystone Initiative. We're excited to be able to kind of expand our partnership with BLM on water quality assessment and to increase assessments of baseline conditions of surface waters for over a larger area in the Arctic, Yukon, and Kuskokwim region. Secondarily is the sewer overflow stormwater reuse municipal grant. This should be note there's a correction on this, that the UGF should be a GF match for those federal dollars. This grant program is intended to address sewer overflow, sanitary sewer overflows, as well as stormwater management, and it's subawarded through two eligible projects.
Just going back for a moment to that slide, if I might. I'm trying to get a sense of. So are these increments, these are ILDA funds, are they going to, are we going to need to have, replace those with general fund money next year? Or is that why they say they're temporary? I'm not entirely certain.
Yeah, through the chair. For the BLM, those that funding runs through 2028 through the federal dollars. We do not anticipate requesting a GF in the future for that, as well as the stormwater, this overflow and stormwater reuse. That grant, I believe, goes is consistent, and the second one, the one time, is a was last year's, and we're allowed to apply for it this year. The cost moving forward for that would be the 42.6 general fund match to receive the 170.4 federal dollars in future years.
Okay, thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Ms. Kohler, you're doing a great job, and I want people to know that. But I don't understand what the gravel-to-gravel Keystone Initiative is. So I have no idea what that means.
Through the chair, we are happy to get you kind of a better description of what that is. I would be remiss to attempt to explain it at my level, but it's funding that BLM was received to be able to pursue this program. Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. This is a very fun one for me. For the record, Jason Bruni, D.C. Commissioner. This was just introduced in the governor's amended budget last week. I think many of you have seen the roadshow. We've been speaking before many committees on this issue. So as I started off in my first slide, federal government passes laws, primacy programs, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and states under a federalist system have the opportunity to take on those programs. Clean Air Act, we obviously have had primacy for over 51 years. As I mentioned, the NPDES program, we've had primacy for the better part of 15 years. This past year, the legislature approved us to become the 49th state to apply for primacy for the RCRA program, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. So we will be submitting our application, and in July of 24, we likely, hopefully, will get a blessing from the EPA for that. With respect to the 404 program, the legislature was very generous this past year and gave us $1 million to study the feasibility study of a 404 program. Now, let me back up to 2013. The legislature passed the Senate 17-2 and the House, I think it was 26-13 or something like that. I know my numbers are a little off, but the SB 27 was passed in 13, basically instructing DEC to pursue primacy of the 404 dredge and fill program. So at that time, the legislature gave us the authority to do it, and that remains in statute. Soon thereafter, oil prices crashed. The program had not yet been fully assumed by the state, and they thought that was an easy item because oil prices were literally a third of what they were. And so they had to cut something, so they cut the efforts by DEC to pursue this program. Fast forward to 2018, the governor asked me right after we started, what's the one thing you could do, Jason, to improve both the investment climate of the state as well as the environment? And I said, we need to do what the legislature instructed us to do. We need to assume the 404 program. So it took 3 years, but last year we put the numbers in the budget. As you all know, the legislature gave us $1 million to further study it. We're very excited with the study that we did. We had a firm, Jade North, that did an independent study of this, and ultimately the recommendation was to go forward with the state assuming this program. Three states have primacy in the 404 program. Florida just recently assumed it, and we all know about their wetlands.
I mean, the Everglades are world-renowned, and they have that local expertise to be able to oversee their wetlands. New Jersey and Michigan have had primacy of their program for decades. There are a number of states that are also considering pursuing primacy of the 404 program right now. We are obviously one of those states. The increment to be able to do this is roughly $5 million and 28 positions for this year. That will be UGF funded. Next year, the number will go to 32 positions, so an additional 4 positions next year, but the dollar amount actually will fall to $4.7 million. After that point, the application process has to be UGF funded. But like the NPDES program, like the RCRA program, like the AIR program, these primacy programs are usually funded through a combination of federal dollars, state dollars, as well as fees charged to the regulated community. We have made a commitment on the record multiple times that we will be looking at a fee program to help diversify the funding sources for this program going forward. Again, $4.7 million will be the annual cost of administering a program. Currently, there is not federal funding for the 404 program for the other three states that have it, but we are pursuing that with the delegation as well as with the Environmental Council of States. That's my colleagues, commissioners of DEC nationwide. We believe that there should be funding if the states are going to be taking on these efforts. There should be funding coming from the federal government. So I anticipate in a couple of years that that $4.7 million currently GF-funded program will be diversified into fees from the regulated community, federal government receipts, and potentially general fund as well. So that's, I believe, the last slide, but I know that there's probably a lot of questions on this issue. So, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present.
Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Galvin.
Through the Chair, Commissioner, my understanding is that Michigan, I don't know if this is still Governor Whitmer's posture toward this, but that they are interested in returning the program to the federal government. Do you know, and they were one of the three states you listed, do you know anything about whether that's true?
So through the Chair, Representative Josephson, one of my close colleagues on the Environmental Council of States is the commissioner of their DEC, and I had extensive conversations with her. That never has come up. She says that the program is going fantastically, that they love having that local oversight, having that local knowledge that helps them not only permit projects going forward, but protect the environment and responsibly develop their wetlands. So everything I've heard about Michigan is that things are going swimmingly.
Okay. Follow up?
Follow up.
Another state that you highlighted, Florida, has had to request funding for an additional 17 positions. And I have some concerns about growing government in this program, given that the Army Corps of Engineers staff that monitors these requirements are closer to 50 staff and about $8 million, I'm told. So why can we do it with 32 and less than 5?
Yeah, through the Chair, Representative Josephson, fantastic question. Thank you for that. First of all, Florida has a great problem we all want to have. They have so much development that's going on because people are moving to Florida wanting to telework and build their homes that 404 permits are going through the roof. We have more wetlands than the lower 48 combined, but so we have 175 million acres of wetlands. We've only developed 0.1% of those. Lower 48 used to have 200 million acres of wetlands. They've developed over half of that. The issue is not how many wetlands you have, but it's how many activities you have, how much development you have occurring. Florida has so many more projects happening than we have in Alaska that they need more staff. So that's the reason, obviously, why they're asking for incremental or increases of 17 employees. With respect to your number about the Corps of Engineers has 48 employees, and we're suggesting that we could do it with 32. The Corps of Engineers, Representative Josephson, is still going to maintain around 25% of the permitting authority, even if we get assumption of the 404 program. Full stop. That Rivers and Harbors Act, they are not allowed. Congress does not allow them to delegate that authority. The Corps of Engineers will still have a role in this process. And so that's why we also believe that through general permits, we're going to be able to, our staff will be able to do what we're saying is 18 actions per year, whereas the number that the Corps of Engineers does currently is 16 actions per employee per year. We believe we can get more efficient use of that through the use of the general permit. So hopefully, Representative Josephson, that answers your question.
Well, I'm going to come back to this and see what other questions there are, but I would be interested in basically the stakeholder class to the extent that they would welcome these fees you've talked about. I would look forward to seeing that sort of correspondence.
At some point. Sure. Representative Josephson, through the chair, I have had conversations with placer miners, with home builders, with folks at Associated General Contractors. A lot of them, they want that increased customer service. They want that accountability. They want that Alaska expertise overseeing their programs. And they have said to me, we're willing to pay for that. We've seen a number of organizations from RDC to the Associated General Contractors, the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, the State Chamber, a number of organizations have come out and endorsed this. And I've been nothing but transparent with them and saying that during this process, we are committed to talking about fees, talking about them like we did. So I was involved in helping pass the agency fees bill back in 2000 or 2001. That allowed us to be able to pass the cost of permitting onto the regulated community. We did it with the NPDES program. There was a lot of interest in having that local expertise at DEC oversee the program. Similar interest has been expressed by these stakeholders, by these regulated entities that want the state to have this program and are willing to pay to play.
Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. I had a question that was similar to Representative Josephson through the chair, but it's a little bit different. So if I'm hearing you correctly, the idea is to get more control over the permitting so that it is more efficient for our stakeholders, correct? That's the goal.
So through the chair, Representative Galvin, that is a goal. Mm-hmm. I think having a more efficient process, having one entity that we're dealing with. Remember those 401 certifications that I was talking about? Now that the Corps, when they do a 404 permit, the Corps has to do their 404 permit, then they have to give it to DEC to do a 401 certification. So we would be ensuring that that 401 certification, that wouldn't be necessary anymore. In addition, we have the opportunity to actually improve the environment with this program. The compensatory mitigation program, the flexibility that we will have overseeing this program, will add huge environmental benefits. Now, let me give you an example. The lower 48, as I said, has developed over half of their wetlands. Because of the amazing ecological benefits that wetlands provide, you need wetlands. Destroying them is not always a good thing. The compensatory mitigation, we've all heard about no net loss. So we want to make sure if you develop 1 acre of wetland, you're either creating 1, 5, 10, 15 acres of new wetlands. Well, in Alaska, we have so many wetlands, that's not necessarily the best alternative. Another option that the Corps of Engineers provides is putting lands in perpetual conservation easements. Well, we have 150 million acres of lands in the state that are in perpetual conservation easements, conservation system units, that we don't need that either. Why not have the projects that are going to be developing a road, developing a new fish processing plant, developing an oil facility or a mine, why not have them clean up a contaminated site, put in a new fish passage, a culvert, or even eliminate honey buckets in a community? Those are benefits environmentally that we'll actually recognize here instead of money being thrown into a mitigation bank where no one knows where it's actually benefiting. So a lot of opportunities, not just from a permitting streamlining, but from an environmental perspective as well.
Thank you. May I have a follow-up, please?
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. So and eventually we're looking at federal, state, and fees to help pay for this changeover. And you mentioned 28 positions. I think that's what's on the slide at first, and that Army Corps would have about a quarter of there, so roughly maybe 12 more in addition, so we're looking at 40. Currently, the Army Corps has 48, and I'm just, for me, I'm just looking after dollars and making sure we don't have lawsuits down the road because we haven't covered ourselves enough. So are you expecting that these 40 positions initially will still be able to get the work done that it needs to be done, I guess is my question.
Yeah, thanks to the chair, Representative Galvin. Great question. I'm going to first address the 12 or 15 or 20 positions with the Corps of Engineers. I have no idea how many they're going to maintain, and that's not our budget. Whatever they ultimately choose to do, that's their choice for what they still have to maintain. They do currently have 48 positions. They're definitely going to call some of those positions, but I can't speak for them. Mm-hmm. We, through the feasibility study, looked at length into the number of activities that are done on an annual basis. And the Jade North feasibility study said that 32 positions would be sufficient to be able to maintain that program at the level of economic activity that we're currently seeing today. If we have a boom and there's new mines, there's new fish processing plants, there's new housing developments, that's a great problem to have because additional economic activity will lead to more royalties to the state, will lead to more taxes to the state, and we'll be able to afford that. So I see it as an absolute win-win for the state taking on this program.
Thank you.
We're going to take this one last question. I mean, obviously, this could be a full committee hearing. One last question, Representative Josephson.
Well, I was hoping for two, but through the chair, Commissioner, the change of remedies from a no net loss to, hey, let me clean up something instead, is that, why does that follow from assumption? In other words, does the Clean Water Act let us do that if we assume and sort of come up with our own remedies for mitigation?
Yeah. Representative Josephson, through the chair, thank you. Perfect question. I wonder the same thing because the Corps of Engineers currently has that flexibility through a 2018 memo that was signed, but it's rarely implemented. And so you'll see up at CD5, ConocoPhillips wrote a check for $7 million for into a mitigation bank that no one has any clue where did that money go? What did it help? Did it help anything in the watershed? Did it help anything in Alaska? We have no idea. The Donlin Project, their mitigation opportunities, they wanted to, as an option, they wanted to clean up the historic Red Devil mine. They weren't allowed. Instead, this is when I was at SERI, Representative Josephson, I negotiated a deal where we put a perpetual easement, a conservation easement on land that was never going to be developed anyway. So there's no added environmental benefit. So the flexibility exists for the Corps of Engineers. They just don't implement it. And if we had the program, that's going to be a priority. Clean up contaminated sites on ANCSA lands. Get rid of the honey buckets. Let's put new fish passage in. Let's actually have things that positively benefit the watersheds where activity is occurring so that there really is a no net loss. In fact, it will be an improvement for that community, for those areas.
All right. Well, very good. I don't think anyone could be any more enthusiastic about DEC issues than you, Commissioner Bruni, and we appreciate your presentation today. So thank you very much. I appreciate that. And yeah, that was to be the last question. We didn't get through all the papers? Well, Representative Cronk, hold on just one moment. Let me check here. Let me check the question tabulator. Oh, you've got a few questions left. So one more question.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. Through the chair, can we go back to page 8? A question I see in looking at the funds, what you've got IJA Other and IJA Fed. What is IJA Other and IJA Fed?
The chair, Representative, let me also flip back through my pages as well. Yeah, so through our through the chair, our IJA Other includes things like capital improvement projects receipts as well as clean water and drinking water admin fund EJ dollars. And I believe there was a second part of that question.
In IJA Fed.
Oh, and IJA Fed, Yeah, I'm happy to answer that. So that's also our federal receipts, our ability to accept those to accept federal dollars.
Follow up. In my very short experience here, whenever federal dollars, whether it's, let's say, a school district gets a grant and they get it for 3 years, it runs out, but they think, God, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. As we do this, I see all this federal money. Are we going to expect to see that, if there's no more EISA funds, are we going to expect to see that drop back down to normal funding?
Yep.
Or are we going to ask to keep it growing?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Cronk, thank you for that question. This is the exact reason why you'll see on a slide like this, I insisted on having it separated. I don't want to see the growth of government for DEC going forward. But these are opportunities that, I mean, it's free money. Now, my boss, Governor Dunleavy, said, always be careful about the allure of free money because there are always going to be ongoing operating expenses once that free money stops. I agree, but a lot of this money is replacing the honey buckets. It's bringing clean water during a pandemic to 32 communities that don't have safe drinking water. It's important, but I have insisted that we differentiate, you'll see in the light yellow numbers, where those EJIA dollars are so that in the future we will not, when those EJIA dollars are gone, we won't see the continued growth of DEC staff.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kohler and Mr. Bruni, Commissioner Bruni, for your presentation. Tomorrow we actually have a double header. We will have from the Department of Revenue a presentation from Adam Crum, Commissioner Designee, and also a presentation from the Department of Corrections, the Commissioner Designee, Jennifer Winkleman. With no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned.